Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Conspiracy You Can Believe In. If you listened to the last episode, that was about the slave power, a really popular conspiracy theory from the mid-19th century about how slave owners, especially very wealthy ones, had captured the federal government with the intention of making it the business of the U.S. federal government of protecting slavery and expanding it wherever possible. As we discussed in that episode, a lot of that conspiracy theory turned out to be true. And the problem of the so-called slave power was not fully solved until the Civil War, until slavery was finally ended through physical force. And I promised at the end of that episode that the bonus would be about some of the black soldiers that finally drove the nail in that coffin. So I wanted to talk about specifically the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. Now, I should say at the top, these bonus episodes are not about conspiracies. They're just about other topics that were related to another episode that I did or just extra bits of research that I found interesting. They're also not scripted, so I'm just talking from an outline here. But I really love the story of the 54th Massachusetts. If you've seen the movie Glory from 1989, it was a very Oscar bait type film, very designed to manipulate you emotionally, but it is a good movie, and I would say probably the best war movie ever made. I really like it, and there's a lot of it that was historically accurate. But what I'm basing much of this episode on is a book called A Brave Black Regiment by Luis Emilio. Luis Emilio was a white officer in the 54th Massachusetts. He served with them from the time that they were first sent out from Boston in 1863 until they were mustered out in Boston in 1865. And all of this is based on his own eyewitness accounts as well as the accounts of other soldiers from the regiment and other officers. So it's very good source material because he was actually there and he's basing it on what other people saw as well. I also want to take a minute to talk about the issue of black soldiers serving in the Civil War. Now, officially, it did not start until 1863, New Year's Day, the same day the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. However, before this happened, when the Union Army began to land in the South along the coastal islands of South Carolina and North Carolina, escaped slaves would flee to Union lines. These were referred to legally as contrabands, meaning contrabands of war, as in captured property. Because legally, under the old United States, these people would be considered property of their former slave owners. But these slave owners were now in rebellion to the United States. That meant that they just weren't being returned. They were in a weird legal limbo that kept them out of slavery, but they didn't quite have that legal freedom yet. Certain generals, like General Benjamin Butler, used this as a way to basically hurt the Confederacy by allowing large numbers of escaped slaves past Union lines, you know, thereby encouraging more to escape. Now, a lot of people in the North, especially people like Frederick Douglass, knew that this had a lot of potential to destroy the Southern economy. And if you arm the slaves, it would fill the ranks of the Union Army, and especially with very, very motivated troops, because these former slaves would be desperate to fight for their freedom. It would change the entire aim of the war into a very deep ideological one. And they argued with Lincoln about this and really put pressure on him to arm black soldiers and to use them in the war against the Confederacy. Finally, in 1863, he gave in. The Emancipation Proclamation, although it did not free slaves in Kentucky, the slave states that were still part of the Union or in behind Union lines, it meant that every forward step of the Union Army, slavery would no longer be allowed in those territories. So we owe a lot to abolitionists like Frederick Douglass for continuing to push for things like the Emancipation Proclamation and for the arming of black troops, because I think it was one of the major factors leading to Union victory. There is also the issue of the myth of black Confederate troops. And I wanted to talk about this because, I grew up in Alabama. This is a thing that it became popular to say in the 20th century that, there were black Confederate soldiers too. However, there is no instance anywhere in letters, eyewitness accounts, the Confederate officers' own accounts of black soldiers being used in combat roles for the Confederacy. The closest that we get is this thing called the Louisiana Native Guard. This was a Confederate regiment made of people of both African and European descent. In Louisiana, they were of mixed race, and they joined this Confederate regiment made of what is called free people of color. It was a different social class in Louisiana, and when Louisiana seceded from the Union for several different reasons, these free black men formed a Confederate regiment. However, they were never used in combat, and they were never recognized officially by the state legislature. When Admiral Farragut came in and took New Orleans in 1862, rather than evacuating to be used in further combat as they were ordered, they stayed behind, and a good number of them actually joined the Union and became the Louisiana Native Guard for the Union. That was actually the first black regiment for the Union Army, and they were used in combat. The issue of arming black soldiers as official soldiers was debated in the Confederate Congress. It was always a minority position and never entertained until the very end of the war, when some black soldiers were in the process of training and then the war ended. There were a lot of black people at the front in the South during the Civil War, but they were there as slaves. They were not there by their own free will, and they were used as laborers and not as soldiers, because the fear of arming large numbers of African Americans in the South was one of the biggest fears of the ruling planter class. They were terrified of a slave rebellion. Arming large numbers of black people is not something that they were going to do. So that is a very persistent myth. It is what I would say is a lost cause myth. It is not true. There were, however, large numbers of black soldiers on the Union side, and that's what this story is about. So the story of the 54th Massachusetts starts in early 1863, when Governor John Andrew, who was an abolitionist governor who served during the Civil War, begins the process of recruitment for this regiment. Now, one of the first people he reaches out to is the family of Robert Gould Shaw. Robert Gould Shaw is a young man. He's an officer in the Union Army. He's served in Maryland and in the defense of D.C. only in his mid-20s, but he's already a veteran. And what's more important is he's from a very prominent abolitionist family in Boston. His family is friends with the governor, and he's promised to be the colonel of this regiment. At this time, the War Department is not allowing black soldiers to serve as commissioned officers. They can be sergeants and corporals and stuff like that, but they can't get anything lieutenant or higher because of segregation at the time. Now, one of the main recruiters for the 54th was Frederick Douglass. Two of his own sons would join the regiment, and he went all across the state. He went to black churches in Boston, in New Bedford, and in a lot of other towns throughout New England, recruiting from among the free black population. Now, Massachusetts at the time was, I believe, the only state that offered citizenship to free black men. No other state did this. So they saw Massachusetts as a prime target for one of the first all-black regiments in the Union Army. They also had to go to Philadelphia to recruit among the free black population there. So I think there were at least two companies that came from Philadelphia. There was a large free black population there. Now, most of the soldiers of the 54th, unlike you, what you saw in the movie Glory, most of them were free black people that had lived in Massachusetts for some time. A lot of them had established careers as either artisans, farmers, or fishermen. Many of them were mixed race. They had been from families that had lived in New England and intermarried with other families for several generations. But there were some escaped slaves that had made their way to Massachusetts over the years. And I'll talk about one of those escaped slaves later on in the story. He would go on to win the Medal of Honor. But they gather all the men. They train them. Colonel Shaw is a very capable commander. He is well-liked by the men. He likes them. He remarks about how good they are at learning the trade of being a soldier. And they march off to war. They go through the streets of Boston in this huge parade. And Emilio describes the parade, and he just rattles off all these names of like people you might have read about in history books. He talks about how Frederick Douglass is there, you know, the governor, Andrew is there. And then they go past Wendell Phillips' house, who was a prominent abolitionist that we talked about in the last episode. And William Lloyd Garrison is out on Wendell Phillips' porch. And as the 54th marches past, Garrison puts his hand on a bust of John Brown that is standing there. The 54th goes past, and they also go past a man named Thomas Sims. Thomas Sims was a black man. He was an escaped slave who came from Georgia about 10 years earlier. And this was a huge story in the papers that he escaped to freedom, and the people of Boston didn't want to give him up. But because of the fugitive slave law, they had to. They were forced to send him back to the South. He was taken by force by U.S. Marshals. He escaped again that year and came back to Boston, just in time to see the 54th Massachusetts, the first armed black regiment from the state, go off to war. And they got on a ship and they went down to South Carolina. And in South Carolina, along the Sea Islands around Beaufort, Port Royal, the Department of the South had established a foothold. And a lot of the generals here, like General David Hunter, they were abolitionists themselves. And they were kind of experimenting with this newly freed population of slaves that were coming in to Union lines all throughout the Lowcountry of South Carolina. So as they got off the boat, this was the world that the 54th was coming into. You know, this new world that was being created out of one of the first places where slavery took hold on the North American continent. There was another regiment already in action called the 2nd South Carolina. Most of these men were escaped slaves that got behind Union lines and were given guns and training. And very briefly, I want to talk about one of the things that the 2nd South Carolina did. Under the command of a guy named Colonel James Montgomery. James Montgomery is someone who shows up in the movie Glory. He's seen as kind of a villain. I think he's kind of a conflicted figure because this was a guy who was what's called a Jayhawker. He actually rode with John Brown out in Kansas before the Civil War, going around freeing slaves, attacking slaveholders, and taking those guerrilla tactics down to South Carolina. He worked with Harriet Tubman and the 2nd South Carolina Infantry. Right when the 54th got there, they went up the Combahee River, this river in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, and Harriet Tubman had established a network of spies, basically, around this area to find the maximum number of people that they could free from these large plantations. And they got them on these barges, and they freed over 700 people in one operation. And I think that was the largest number of slaves freed in any operation throughout the Civil War. So already, when the 54th Massachusetts arrived, there were these guerrilla tactics going on where armed black troops were going on expeditions to go and free other former slaves behind enemy lines. It's a very fascinating thing to be dropped into. And one of the first expeditions that the 54th went on, they were shipped down to Darien, Georgia. Colonel Shaw goes with Colonel Montgomery. Montgomery, you know, he's this bushwhacker guy from Kansas. He's very used to total war. He shows up in Darien and he burns the town. Colonel Shaw is horrified. He writes to General Hunter, you know, is this actually what we're doing? I'm not going to say anything if these are the orders, but I don't think they are. It turns out, yes, they are the orders. Colonel Montgomery explains to him, and he actually says this, quote, "The Southerners must be made to feel this is a real war and be swept away by the hand of God, like the Jews of old." So that's like a very 19th century way of saying, I'm going to go Old Testament on these people. And he burned houses, he burned crops, plantations especially, because that's where the wealth was. And in Montgomery's mind, you know, some people hear this and like, oh, that's horrible. But one, he wasn't killing civilians. He was burning plantations, which were, you know, slave labor camps. And he was burning food that was going to be used for armies. His whole point was, look, we have to make them feel the war here, and then they're going to end it. But they're not going to do it any other way. Now, there are other things that I think complicate the image of Colonel Montgomery then that I'll get into later, but I don't think it's this. I'm sorry. So the 54th returns from Georgia, and they still have not seen real combat yet. And there are two things complicating this. Number one is that they were promised $13 a month by the government. Now, that is the standard pay at the time for any U.S. soldier. What they are actually getting is $10 a month. Now, $10 a month is what the War Department is giving to the so-called contraband of war. These are the former slaves that escape, go behind Union lines, and sign up for the Army. The War Department was only giving those people $10 a month, and they were giving the same pay to the 54th Massachusetts. Obviously, the motivation here was racism, and the 54th refused to stand for it. They took no pay at all. Not the enlisted men, not the officers. They took no pay until this issue got settled in 1864, and they were given the full pay that they were promised. So this would be going on for over a year. So keep in mind, when I say what happens next, they are getting no pay. The other thing that happens is the Confederate Congress, once it finds out that the Union Army is arming black soldiers, issues a proclamation that any black soldier and white officer leading black soldiers that's captured is going to be brought to a state court and put on trial for servile insurrection. Now, the punishment for servile insurrection in the Confederacy is death. So basically, if you are a black soldier or a white officer in a black regiment and you're captured, you are 100% going to be killed by the Confederates. That is a war crime. And Lincoln responded with his own proclamation saying that if you kill one of our soldiers, we're going to kill one of yours. So the 54th is out there getting no pay with the understanding that if they are captured, they are probably going to get killed, and they're going to war anyway. So when they get back from Georgia, the first armed major encounter that the 54th has is at this place called Grimble's Landing. It's on James Island, just outside of Charleston. The operation here was intended to draw reinforcements that are going to Fort Wagner away from the fort so that the Union Army can assault the fort. Fort Wagner is this big earthworks fortress that is just outside of Charleston. It's guarding the harbor, and it is keeping the Union Navy from getting into the harbor and shelling Charleston. So they got to get the forces away from there, and they're doing that by leading this assault on James Island. So the Union Army is getting into a position where on their left flank they have an impassable swamp. And further off to the right, they have these woods, and then eventually the ocean. Of course, the goal is to draw Confederate forces to them and away from reinforcing the fort. But they probably draw too much, because they get a large enough Confederate force going around into a position where they can flank them and encircle them and capture all of the regiments. So the 54th is there on the right. To their left is the 10th Connecticut. And to the 10th Connecticut's left is the swamp. When rebel forces start coming in from the right, the 54th has to wheel around and meet them. And they do. Huge Confederate attack comes in. 54th stands its ground. They open fire. They engage with bayonets. And they repulse the attack. It's only about 5 minutes, but it gives the 10th Connecticut just enough time to slip away and prevent the entire Union army there from getting encircled and captured. They are exhausted. The 54th has just repulsed a Confederate attack and had to beat a speedy retreat away. They're getting on boats. They're going back to the Union camp, and they're met with cheers. People are saying, "Hurrah, hurrah, you saved the 10th Connecticut." Other officers are sending their thanks to Colonel Shaw and commending him on his training and on his men's discipline and how well they conducted themselves at the Battle of Grimble's Landing. Technically, it's not a Union victory. It's kind of an inconclusive conflict, but they saved the Union Army from total disaster. And that's a theme we're going to see with the 54th throughout this episode. Now, the next engagement does not go that well for the 54th. It doesn't really go well for anybody in the Union Army, and that is the storming of Fort Wagner. Now, if you've seen the movie Glory, you know how this ends, and it's not good. Fort Wagner is this large earthworks fortification on the north end of Morris Island, and it blocks the entrance to Charleston Harbor. There is a narrow strip of sand leading up to it. It's the only approach on land to get to Fort Wagner. And the 54th is given by General George C. Strong the place of honor in the assault. They're going to be the first regiment up there. The problem is, because the approach is so narrow, only one regiment at a time can go up to the fort, and that's only if they squeeze and turn around to get onto the battlements. Now keep in mind, they've got musket fire up there, they've got cannons, but they're going to do it anyway. So Colonel Shaw accepts the place of honor, and the assault begins that evening, July 18th, 1863. And as they're going up the beach, shot is beginning to fall on them. They're not breaking ranks. They're going double quick. They start to run. They get almost up to the battlements. They're near the walls of the fort as musket fire and canister shot is ringing out, killing, maiming, wounding, sending sand and shrapnel up, blinding people. It's just a horrible place to be, but they are sticking with it. Finally, Colonel Shaw is able to get up on the parapet. He has his color guard next to him, bringing the flag up. He gets up onto the top of the outer wall, holds up his sword, and says, "Forward, 54th," and gets shot through the heart and dies instantly. But people follow him up there. They get up on the wall, and they actually get into the first part of the fortress. For about an hour, they are fighting Confederates on top of the wall. They almost get to the point where they can spike the guns, but there's just too many of them. The generals on the Union side have underestimated the size of the garrison of Fort Wagner. It is probably going to be impossible for the 54th to carry this through on their own. And unfortunately, it is almost pitch black. Can't really see except for the occasional explosions happening. And the 54th is accidentally fired upon by a Union regiment that's behind them. And keep in mind, this approach to Fort Wagner is so narrow. They have to squeeze one regiment at a time. They just can't get enough people in there to overwhelm the Confederates. So they're bottlenecked in. As fierce as they're fighting, the 54th, there's just not enough of them to take Fort Wagner. They're repulsed from the walls. They're kind of stuck in this thing called a rifle pit, a little trench just outside the walls. They're getting shot at. They're getting hit with canister shot. And finally, the survivors are able to get out of there and retreat. There were about 600 men in the 54th that took part in the assault on Fort Wagner. About 100 of them died. 150 were wounded, many of them severely. About a dozen were captured, and over 50 were missing, and those people were presumed dead because they probably got captured and killed if they went behind Confederate lines. So they had an almost 40% casualty rate in one of their first big battles, but it didn't stop them. And I think one of the stories that illustrates the resilience of the 54th Massachusetts is the story of William Kearny. William Kearny was an escaped slave from Virginia who made his way up to New Bedford, Massachusetts. And once he started living there as a free man, he signed up for the 54th. And during the siege of Fort Wagner, during the confusion of the battle, he got the flag as it was falling and held on to it. Up there, clinging to the walls of the fort as he's being shot at with cannon and musket balls. But he still knows that he has to bring this flag back to Union lines. And as he's able to escape, he gets shot in the hip. He's crawling. He gets helped up by another Union soldier from another regiment. That person falls. He finally makes it to safety. And he's put in the hospital. And as his comrades are around him, asking him what happened, he says, "The old flag never touched the ground." This would be the first incident for which an African American was given the Medal of Honor ever in the United States. It was William H. Kearny. And he would survive the war. He went on to back to New Bedford, where he worked as a letter carrier and a union leader, actually. He would establish a local for the National Association of Letter Carriers, which is a union that has a long history with the African American community in the United States. William H. Kearny was a very early prominent figure in that union. So that's a cool thing about him. Now, the 54th, after Fort Wagner, began to be replenished with more and more recruits from Massachusetts. People saw what happened. There were newspaper reporters there. There were other generals there that watched the bravery of the 54th under fire. And word got out. And thousands of more African Americans joined the Union Army because of what they did that day. It was a loss on the battlefield, not because of the actions of the 54th, but it was a massive propaganda victory for the Union Army, because Fort Wagner would become a rallying cry for the 54th, and it would become this motivation for thousands of other recruits for the Union Army. They would eventually get a sister regiment, the 55th Massachusetts. That was another black regiment from Massachusetts that would soon join them in South Carolina. After the infantry assault on Fort Wagner failed, the Union Army basically figured the way to deal with Fort Wagner was just to blow it up. They established a massive entrenchment in the swamps outside of Charleston. With the 54th, because again, of racist reasons, given the bulk of the work of building the entrenchments and setting up the cannons, which was very grueling labor, the 54th did most of that, and these cannons basically swept Fort Wagner off the map. It wasn't officially surrendered, but they found only some deserters left inside, and it was not a place where people could live once the Union cannons were done with it. They also pretty much made Fort Sumter outside of Charleston unusable, but Charleston itself was not giving up, and they would be besieging Charleston for a long period of time, and the people that built those siege works were the 54th. They were given the worst labor and, again, paid nothing. Now, when the paymaster came from the federal government and tried to give them $10 a month, they were still refusing. At this point, Colonel James Montgomery, remember that bushwhacker that had been leading these, you know, daring raids into rebel territory and freeing slaves and stuff, he starts to get mad at the 54th. And Luis Emilio recounts a very racist speech that Colonel Montgomery gives them, telling them that, like, they need to be thankful for what they're getting. One of the lines he says is, "You have not yet proven yourselves as soldiers." Keep in mind, this is just after the assault on Fort Wagner. And he goes into this very bizarre rant about black people, and Emilio doesn't even include most of it in his book because he is so offended by what Colonel Montgomery says. The 54th just sits there, they listen to it, and they say, you know what, we're still not taking this pay. It's $13 or nothing. Eventually, in 1864, after almost like 18 months of getting nothing, the federal government comes to a compromise where they say, okay, if you can prove that you were free in April of 1861 when the war started, you will get $13 a month. Now, by this point, a lot of the men of the 54th Massachusetts are not freeborn men. Many of them are actually escaped slaves by this point. So they just take an oath at the urging of the white officers. They basically tell them, look, just take the oath. We're not going to turn you in. We want you to get $13. And so they do, and that's how they finally get full pay. They are very bitter about this, and Luis Emilio is very upset that they had to lie under oath, but that was the only way they could get paid. And that's finally how that $13 issue was resolved. After the siege works of Charleston were set up, a guy named General Quincy Gilmore has a plan to invade Florida. Now, Florida at the time has a lot of cattle, some cotton. It hasn't really been touched by the war yet. It's probably not very well defended. If you send a Union army down there, maybe we can knock it out of the Confederacy. So General Gilmore sends an expedition force with this guy, General Truman Seymour. It includes the 54th. They land at Jacksonville, Florida. And at first, they don't meet much resistance. They go out a little bit from Jacksonville. They meet some state militia, not very well trained. They're able to take some land. But Seymour was ordered to stay put for a second, wait for more reinforcements, and see what happens. Now, unfortunately, that also gives Florida time to gather more reinforcements, and General Joseph Finnegan, who is the commander, the rebel commander in Florida, starts to bring in troops from Georgia and amass a large force there. General Seymour thinks that he's had enough time waiting. He's going to go further into Florida, and matter of fact, he's going to follow the railroad all the way to Tallahassee and see if he can take the capital. So in between waiting around for reinforcements to show up and then disobeying orders and pushing ahead way further than you were supposed to go, this does not end well for the Union Army. After pushing through Florida without a lot of resistance, they're finally met with a full Confederate force under Joseph Finnegan at a place called Alusty. Now here, thousands of Confederates have been able to build some kind of fortification. They are establishing battle lines. They are trying to draw the Union Army into a pitched battle, which it might lose by this point because they have pushed so far into the state. They've stretched out their supply lines. They're really far away from Jacksonville where they landed. But Seymour by this point is still pretty sure he's facing these state militia troops that aren't very good. So he pushes his troops ahead and they lose the battle. They are able to get away, mostly intact, though, once again, thanks to the 54th Massachusetts. The 54th, realizing that there's a hole in Union lines, fills it and repulses a Confederate attack when they're trying to push the Union Army, encircle it, and capture as many of them as they can. They're held back by the 54th, and the Union Army is eventually able to get back to Jacksonville and leave the state. Now, one thing that I thought was kind of weird reading this was Colonel Montgomery was in charge of the 54th at Alusty, but he was still trying to do his guerrilla warfare tactics in a pitched battle, and they needed to do an ordered retreat because they were covering the rear of the Union Army. They needed to let these other guys get out of there, so they needed to fall back and keep falling back in an ordered way. But Montgomery, his order literally read, quote, "Now, men, you have done well. I love you all. Each man take care of himself." So he wanted them to just scatter, you know, in this Confederate state where if captured, they would definitely be killed. Thankfully, they did not do that. And they held firm. They repulsed the Confederate attack, and they were able to get the Union Army safely out of Florida. From Florida, they go back to South Carolina, and this is 1864. Sherman is making his way during the March to the Sea. He's getting getting closer and closer to Savannah, Georgia. The 54th is ordered to take part in these raids that would clear the railroads to make way for Sherman and to prevent Confederate reinforcements from getting to Savannah. One of these was called the Battle of Honey Hill, and once again, it's a time when the 54th conveyed themselves with bravery and precision, but were very poorly led and organized because this was just a meat grinder. This was an expedition to secure a railroad to Savannah, but because of bad scouting, the Union Army found a heavily entrenched Confederate force with a swamp in front of it, and there was really no way for the artillery to get an angle on them, so they just kept sending one regiment after another to assault this fortress that really couldn't be assaulted, and they lost a lot of men. The 54th, though, did what they could, but they were in an unwinnable position. Things really started to turn, though, in December of 1864. Now, that is when General Sherman captures Savannah. He starts making his way into South Carolina. And in February of 1865, Charleston finally falls. The 54th is basically on garrison duty, but the only people left are mostly other African Americans. And you can imagine being an African American in Charleston at this time, when the rebel forces have fled, and you see these Union troops, black men armed as official soldiers of the United States government. This has never been done before. And you are in, like, the heart of the Old South. This is like where John C. Calhoun is from. And now the 54th Massachusetts, a black regiment, is occupying it. By this time, also, the 54th is attempting to make some of its black non-commissioned officers commissioned officers. One of them is this guy named Stephen Swales. Now, Colonel Hollowell, Edward Hollowell, he is the colonel that took over from Colonel Shaw, has been trying to get this guy Swales a commission. He's an accomplished soldier. He knows what to do. Hollowell thinks this guy's going to be a great lieutenant, but the War Department won't let him get it. Now, the 54th tries to just say, okay, this guy is a lieutenant now, and see how far that goes, because the thing about Stephen Swales is he's very light-skinned. He is of mixed European and African heritage. He can pass for white. And they just say this guy's a lieutenant, and other generals will believe that. The War Department unfortunately finds out and doesn't allow this to happen. But Hollowell and others will be fighting for him to get his commission throughout the rest of the conflict and after. After General Sherman basically levels Columbia, South Carolina in February of 1865, he starts to push on for North Carolina. But this is going to leave a pocket of Confederate control where sources have told him that there is a lot of railroad and a lot of train cars full of supplies for the Confederate Army. So Sherman orders Brigadier General Edward Potter to take all of the trains in this area, basically hijack a ton of trains, destroy them so the Confederate Army cannot use them for a last-ditch resistance. Now, this is called Potter's Raid, and it's one of the coolest things the 54th Massachusetts ever did, and one of the final engagements of the war. They go into this section of South Carolina, and keep in mind, this entire time, as the 54th has been moving through South Carolina, through Florida, slaves have been escaping and getting to Union lines. Some of them eventually join the military for the Union. Many of them serve as scouts, as spies. They tell them where to go. But everywhere they go, there is a train of people, former slaves, following them. They freed thousands of people this way. And that's also what happened during Potter's Raid. So they're cutting through South Carolina. They're following these railroads. They capture these trains. There's one point where Lieutenant Swales jumps on a train and just takes the engine, and he overcomes it so fast he's accidentally shot in the arm by his own troops because they think he's one of the Confederates. He was okay, but this is how swiftly this engagement happened. At another point, a contingent of troops from the 54th under a Captain Tucker They capture a Confederate train behind enemy lines. Now it's past this bridge that the Union Army has already set fire to try to prevent a Confederate advance. So they have to get this train over that bridge that is already on fire. And it's like, if you've ever seen the movie Sorcerer, that's basically what happened here. They are driving this train full steam over this bridge as it's on fire, and the minute they get on the other side, the bridge collapses. So that's the kind of stuff that was going on during Potter's raid, and the 54th captured all of the trains that Sherman ordered them to. It was full of cannon shot, full of gunpowder, food for the army in Virginia, and they just destroy all of it. So a successful operation. This is followed up with one of the final battles of the Civil War. It actually occurred after the surrender at Appomattox. This is called the Battle of Boykin's Mill. The Union forces get to the town of Boykin. Outside of Columbia, South Carolina, there is a Confederate entrenchment on one side of a mill pond. The Union is on the other side of the mill pond. There's basically no way to attack it, except for a narrow footpath that goes over the river downstream. The problem is they have to rush single file under Confederate fire and get to the other side if they want to clear those Confederates out of the entrenchment. The 54th is up for the job, and they go single file under Confederate fire until they get to the other side, and they rush the Confederate troops and scatter them. This was one of the last battles of the Civil War. Within a week, the army in South Carolina would receive news of both the surrender of Lee's army at Appomattox and the end of the war, and of Lincoln being assassinated in Washington, D.C. Those things happened like within a week of each other. So with very mixed emotions, they go back to Charleston and board a ship and go back to Boston for a hero's welcome. They're mustered out in Boston with a speech from Colonel Edward Hollowell, and he remarks that the men of the 54th left Massachusetts as citizens of a state because Massachusetts was the only state that granted them any kind of citizenship, and they came back to Boston as citizens of an entire country because of what they did. They also had the same flag that they left Massachusetts with. It was tattered, it was shot full of bullets, but it was the same one that they departed Boston with, the same one that was on the walls of Fort Wagner, came back at the end of the war. And I just want to close with what Captain Luis Emilio wrote in A Brave Black Regiment about that flag that the 54th brought back. He said, "The flag is the object of his sentimental devotion, which he has sworn to defend with his life. Every hole in the tattered silk or mark upon its staff tells of valorous strife in a just cause. Each legend inscribed on its stripes is the brief story of regimental glory." Now, I didn't just want to do this episode for Black History Month. That is one of the reasons, but I think they are a stark contrast, the people of the 54th, to the people of the slave power, the John C. Calhouns, the James Henry Hammonds, because those guys were motivated out of self-interest, out of greed, and out of a need to dominate other people. That was their chief goal in life. They tried to take over the government of the United States in order to further those goals, those selfish goals. But the people of the 54th took up arms in service of a government that didn't even grant them full rights in order to defeat those people and to free the people that those men of the slave power held in bondage. And they did defeat them, and they did free them. And they came back with the flag. So I hope you like this story about the 54th Massachusetts. Once again, if you want to read the source material for this, that is the book A Brave Black Regiment by Luis F. Emilio. I can't recommend it enough. It's a great read. Thanks again for listening.